Sagar and Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Now, as we mentioned on Tuesday, we're not going to be airing interviews today or next Thursday due to August vacation work trips, which I hope you'll all indulge us a little bit with. So instead, we have decided to record a special Ask Me Anything episodes because we've literally gotten too many questions from you guys to answer in only one show. And then we want to kick around this new David Brooks piece on the future of the right in the New York Times that actually mentioned me, but it's not just a narcissistic exercise. It's actually something that will be of great interest to everybody who listens to this podcast.
So a quick reminder, as always, be sure to scroll down to the bottom of the Realignments podcast page and leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. And as always, if you leave us a 5-star written review and email us at realignmentpod@gmail.com, we will answer you live on air just like we are this episode. Before we dive into the questions and the David Brooks discussion, we want to offer a huge shout out to Lincoln Network, the organization that we've partnered with the Realignment to sponsor this season. Lincoln Network's focused on exploring the space between Silicon Valley and DC. And as anyone who's listened to our episodes of Biology Srinivasan or Joe Lonsdale knows, an enormous number of our problems are really rooted in this East Coast versus West Coast debate. So anything that deals with gatekeeping, power, the role of technology, that's really going to be the sort of set of issues that Lincoln's focusing on. So Sagar and I are also pumped to participate in the Lincoln Network's post-election 2020 reboot conference. We're going to interview a wide-ranging set of guests. So go to rebootconference.org to learn more and sign up.
And an event at that conference that you guys can all look forward to is with Rachel Bovard, great friend of Rising. She actually recently filled in for me on the show. And we're going to have a really interesting conversation there at that conference about technology, about the right, and how we should all think about it. So I really encourage you guys to go and tune in to all of that. So with all of that, let's dive into some questions, Marshall. I understand we have 7 different questions, lots of questions. What should we got?
So first question, this goes to you, Sagar, first. This is from Calvin, who fittingly mentioned he was our 420th review. Calvin's a Rising viewer, so his obvious question is, Sagar, why are you so against weed legalization? Marshall, I don't quite know your position either.
That's a great question, Calvin. And unfortunately, you were the 420th. Look, I get this question a lot. I definitely troll about it on Twitter, so I understand where you're coming from, Calvin. Here's the thing. Do I think anybody should be in jail for dealing small amounts of marijuana? No. I absolutely accept that there are racist criminal justice implications towards that. Okay, so let's get that out of the way. What does legalization actually convey about weed? It conveys and is a stamp from the government that this thing is okay. Now, you might say, yeah, but alcohol is legal, and so are cigarettes, and everybody knows that those are bad for you. And I would say, yeah, you're right. However, we developed norms around alcohol over the last 5,000 years about whether drinking too much is bad. And in terms of smoking, it literally took 75 years of aggressive government propaganda in order to convince people that smoking is bad, and still 25% of the U.S. population does it. So my concern with legalization is much more about culture than it is about law, because legalization is basically a stamp from the government that weed is good for you. And look, a lot of you who are listening to this podcast, maybe some of you are pot smokers, have probably bought into some of these ridiculous, you know, tweets and Facebook links and YouTube videos of like, oh my God, like cannabis and THC cured this one kid's epilepsy. And I'm like, okay, so it should obviously be legal for that one kid to have THC, but that's not a reason for why you need to get baked and watch cartoons, okay? Especially when you could be doing something that's a little bit more productive. And I think that this is especially destructive in a society where we continue to have lack of opportunity for people, and it just offers yet another venue in order to indulge in listlessness. And that's something that's just not good for civilization as a whole. So I think that's probably the most holistic answer. Marshall, I'll let you weigh in on that.
Yeah, Sagar, my position is directionally in accordance with yours. The area that I'm most focused on is this idea of corporate power and the nature of the actual marijuana industry itself. So if you think about it, we spent more than 75 years basically fighting against big tobacco, which was this massive industry that was using billions and billions of dollars to not only addict people, but actually sort of fight back against truth and facts as related to smoking. So I think the thing we need to prevent from happening now that marijuana is legalized, a policy I largely support, is the emergence of a big marijuana industry that would actually serve to really rebut and fight against sort of the good parts of what legalization could lead to. Because a sort of funny, well, it's not funny, it's actually pretty sad. People who followed this issue have actually noted that a lot of the sort of case for legalizing marijuana was focused around this idea that if we legalized marijuana, it would actually create a lot of opportunity for people. But what we've seen happen is instead of people who went to jail for dealing small amounts of weed getting actual access to this market, it's been big corporations who have taken it over. So I think we should pursue policies that prevent this from becoming a big amalgamated section.
Yeah, that's such an important point. I mean, look, what would happen to the marijuana industry is what would happen to the rest of the economy, and that is financialization, my friends. There's a reason Goldman Sachs and venture capital are all in on pot legalization, and it ain't got anything to do with criminal justice. So, next question here. This is from Michael. He says, what are each of your favorite works of political philosophy with a preference on pre-21st century works? Marshall, what do you think?
I have bad news for Michael. I literally do not read philosophy, nor do I, frankly, have much of an interest in reading it. I'm actually much more interested in history. So two works of history that I think are really important that have shaped both the way that I approach this podcast and the way that I think about the world are, one, the series by Rick Perlstein, starting with Gathering Storm, which is about Barry Goldwater, and that goes into Nixon Land, The Invisible Bridge, which is about the 1974 transition from Nixon to Reagan. And he's actually releasing a new part of this book about Reagan's rise from 1976 to 1980. The book series focuses on the realignment of the United States political system during the 1960s. So that whole frame of focusing on this big structural change rather than just focusing on the policy debates actually comes from that book. And the second thing that's really influenced the way I think about the world is Grand New Party, a book by Ross Douthat and Raihan Salam. We mentioned it last episode. I read it back in high school. And the reason why I enjoyed it so much was it actually changed the way I thought about politics. So for example, in the first chapter, they mention how in 2008, NPR of the public broadcasting system did a survey of Republican voters. And what they did is they took President Obama's, well, then candidate Obama's tax policy, removed the Democrat part of it. They then took George Bush's then president tax policy, removed the Republican label and asked, hey, voters, which do you prefer? It turned out that voters actually preferred, Republican voters, mind you, preferred Obama's 2008 policy of increasing taxes on the wealthy and offering middle-class tax relief. In contrast to George W. Bush's position of focusing on cutting upper income tax cuts, aka supply side economics. So reading that was a revelation for me because you sort of realized, wait a second, but the GOP's actual policy positions aren't in accordance with the way the base actually thinks of a lot of these issues.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point, Marshall. And Michael, I got bad news for you too, which is that there is far too much political philosophy in DC, and there are plenty of podcasts where you can go listen to some conservative dorks talk about Rousseau, and you can talk about Burke, and you can argue over whether you're West Coast Straussian or East Coast Straussians. Frankly, I don't give a shit about any of that. So, sorry, Phil. Producer Phil, you're going to have to put an explicit tag on this one. Look, I care about history as well. I care about the mechanics of power. The reason that I think you're asking this question is because of the corruption of the historical profession. It used to be that history was the study of power. And yet, around the 1960s, it became the story of the oppressed. So realistically, what I would recommend are some similar books here. I recommend the series The Years of Lyndon Johnson. It's been written by Robert A. Caro, a biography of former President Lyndon B. Johnson. It's over 3,000 pages. It's four different books. And the fifth one, which is about Johnson's actual presidency, is not even out. And the reason I do is because it chronicles exactly how one of the greatest politicians in American history went about his business day by day, week by week, and accomplished absolutely masterful feats all the way from the age of 22 and onward. That is a real study of how Washington actually works. And I think that it would serve so many different people well to learn about the actual mechanics of your democracy rather than arguing about what the Constitution should have said or not. I mean, If you think about power and how it manifests, it very rarely manifests itself in a way that political philosophers talk about, and has much, much more to do with discrete choices in public policy. Do we do antitrust or not? How do we have banking laws structured in this country? How do we have bankruptcy laws structured in this country? Student debt obligations, whether you can discharge it or not. Those are the things that I think govern your life, my life, and so many other Americans, and that's what I have a lot more interest in.
To build on the Lyndon Johnson reference, I don't know what this, I don't mean to say this to justify our lack of political philosophizing, but remember, Sagar, Caro points out that Lyndon Johnson literally didn't even read anything. So I think there's an interesting conversation. He literally did not, he didn't read policy books. He didn't read fiction. He wasn't reading airport novels. This was literally a person who didn't read, yet he was able to wield power in this incredibly fascinating way. And you know what? You could argue that his presidency ended so terribly, maybe because he didn't read enough Machiavelli or political philosophy there too. So I don't know what the brief lesson I'm trying to offer is, but I think that's an interesting note.
Yeah. All right. What's the next question here?
Casey asks, lately, I've thought that having more political parties could help the country. What do you guys think this could look like? Where would the fractures occur, and would this be a good thing?
Oh my gosh, you risers and realignment listeners are never going to stop with this third party thing, are you? And look, guys, I mean, we addressed this on the last podcast, which is that having more political parties, having all these other things, it's a nice idea, but I'm interested in the realm of the possible. The realm of the possible is that Donald Trump showed in 2016 that it's far easier to take over an existing political party, basically realign that party towards the actual needs, wants of both its voters and unserved voters in American politics, than it would be realistically to create another one. So I get the idea. I know it's very appealing. It's something that we've done in our history. But actually, if you're interested in learning about what exactly it took to kill the Whig Party in American politics, I recommend you guys read this book that I just finished called Battle Cry of Freedom. It's considered one of the definitive histories of the American Civil War. It took an issue as divisive as slavery, of which both Whigs and the Democrats both were completely inconsistent on, and basically necessitated the birth of a new explicitly anti-slavery party that could cater to the North in order to give birth to the newest Republican Party that we have in American politics. So it takes something that momentous and that kind of titanic in your politics to give birth to a new party. Absent that, I think that it's much more effective in order to go after the millions of American voters who are not served by the current party infrastructure, take over your current party, and use that to push your agenda.
I'll take the second part of the question that's focused on what do we think it could look like and where would the fractures occur. So let's just buy the idea that our political system wasn't structured in a way that basically necessitated only two parties winning. What we would sort of see happen is a regionalization of the political parties. And that's something that I would wager would actually be a good thing for the country. After I'm done, I'm curious what Sagar thinks about that. Because if we had more regional political parties, what you'd see is a version of the Republican Party that's probably in the Northeast and the Atlantic coast. That's much like Charlie Baker's Republican Party. It'd be much like Maryland Governor Larry Hogan's Republican Party. It would be socially liberal, fiscally conservative, and that would make a lot of sense for that party. In the West, you'd probably see a more libertarian-oriented Republican Party. In the Democratic Party, you would almost certainly see a more socialist DSA-type party that would exist in places like New York and urban regions. So on one level, it would probably be healthier because a lot of what causes the tension in our system is the fact that we're forcing all these differing styles of ideologies to fit within one big tent. But on the other hand, to Sagar's point, that's not actually going to happen because the structure of the political system is such that you couldn't actually change that. And if you did want to change that, you would actually need to use the two-party system to do that. So you're sort of stuck in a conundrum there.
Yeah, such an important point. This one is for me. Stephen G. He writes, Sagar, being from Texas myself, hoping to transfer to Texas A&M to George Washington University after the school year, what surprised you the most about D.C. after moving? How did the culture compare to small-town conservative Texas? Oh boy, Stephen, you're opening up a whole can of worms here. Okay, so first of all, I'm going to tell you, I do not think that you should transfer to GW. I say this as a George Washington University alumnus. And I say this as somebody who is, I was happy I went there and so much more. And I don't know that much about you. I don't want to assume too much. One of the things I really learned about being here in DC is that the major selling point for DC-based universities like Georgetown, where I also hold a grad degree from, GW, and American, is the idea that if you're here, that you're inherently better off. And having worked in the labor market here now for a couple of years, it's just not true. In fact, I see often that there are a lot of people who went to state schools like Texas A&M, Marshall went to the University of Oregon, who went to, you know, I'm missing many, you know, fine state schools, who basically leveraged being the political person or the best in their field at that state school and then came to DC via normal channels, like a congressional internship or a semester here in DC or so much more. So I would say, just given the amount and that, you know, Texas A&M is so much cheaper than going to GW, that I would just say, you know, both for your fiscal situation, that the relative advantage you would have by coming here to GW would not necessarily be one that you should take. And before I let Marshall come in here, how does the culture compare to being small town conservative Texas? Well, let's just say I was wearing sneakers with jeans when I got here at the age 18 until my friend and co-host Marshall here put an end to that one pretty quickly. So Marshall, what do you think?
Yeah, so this is a fun question for me, A, because I was technically born in Texas. I moved after day two. So Sagar and every other Texan I've ever met assures me I am not a Texan, but that's just my own little fight to bear. But I think what really matters about this question is, not only is Sagar right in terms of what you're going to get from a DC-based education, but we also should think of this question in the context of COVID-19, which is that if you're going to transfer to DC during this weird quarantine, work from your dorm room space, it's just not worth the price. What's actually much better is to spend your time interning. What I did is I went to University of Oregon, and every summer I stayed in DC. I took the money that I saved actually going to school at University of Oregon in state and spent it on my expensive DC summer housing. So you really should be economical about this. Now, this question does change a bit if you're talking about going to grad school, but I just don't think there's a strong case for transferring to a school like GW. I just don't think the programs are just quite good enough to justify the, what, $30,000 plus a year at a minimum, not even counting cost of living you'll be paying for that degree.
Yeah, that's right. All right, so next question here. This is from Cameron. How can we square our absolute hatred for wonks, political patronage networks, and ossified beltway thinking, despite being products of them and involved in them? Can we ever escape this conundrum? This is an easy one. Marshall, I'll let you go first.
Yeah, Cameron clearly knows Sagar and I in our personal lives, so we appreciate you reaching out with this question. It does speak to a truth here, which is that we launched this podcast within a DC think tank, very traditional. We operate this podcast sponsored by another think tank. So we're running this show that's in many ways speaking to a populist audience, is trying to sort of do something different, but we're still operating within the system. To his point, I don't think it's actually a conundrum, because that's actually sort of the key thing to do here. Because something that I've learned about DC, spending my time here and operating within these institutions, is I've actually gotten a better set of knowledge about how the world actually works. So one of the most frustrating experiences I have is interacting with, for example, rising viewers who are new to the political process, haven't been to DC before, and they sort of assume everything's sort of a conspiracy theory. So they'll say things like, man, Joe Biden and the Democrats really just got together and just stole the 2020 election from Bernie, and man, they just happened to rig all those votes in Iowa, and that's what happened there. Anyone who spent any amount of time in DC, anyone who's gone to bars with these people, knows that that literally is impossible. That didn't happen. And actually, what really just happened is that Joe Biden has a really strong coalition of Black voters in the South and upper middle class suburbanites who were never going to vote for Bernie in the first place. That election outcome had nothing to do with a conspiracy. It had nothing to do with any emails. It just had to do with the fact that the actual coalitions of power that have assembled in DC are not favorable to the populist left. They're favorable to the center neoliberal post-Obama left. So that's a key thing. And I think going to DC and operating from these networks helps you understand that. And if you ever want to break out of those networks, if you ever want to build something new, I think it's critical. I think it's critical that you understand those things.
Yeah, I mean, my answer to you, Cameron, is that you can't beat people unless you know them. And one of the greatest frustrations I have as a political commentator is that I see people who comment on political affairs who have no idea what they're talking about. And one of the, I would say, one of my strategic advantages of political commentating here on this podcast on Rising is I talk to many of the people that I lambast all the time. I talk to Capitol Hill staffers who disagree with me. Trust me, they make sure that they have my phone number and that they DM me on Twitter. That's actually very useful. I talk and am a product of a system of which I am critiquing. The most effective reformers of our time, Teddy Roosevelt, you know, FDR, the people who challenged financial power in this country, the people who secured working class people's economic rights in this country, at least at that time, were both the scions of some of the wealthiest families in America. How did that happen? So you have to be a traitor to your class in order to change it. That's something that I think is a dynamic which is very clear, which is that sometimes pure outsiderism is actually not the best way to affect change, is that you have to work within the system and know the system and also be a heretic of the system in order to get anything done. So that's how I square that one. All right, what's next?
Yeah, and that's actually a great point, Sagar, because this sort of goes to what I think both the populist and the populist right need to think about moving forward, which is that if you're a Bernie person, you look at what happened in this primary, the answer isn't to sort of spend your time talking about how the DNC is just this corrupt thing that stole something from you. I think the answer here is to find someone from the suburbs who could articulate why democratic socialism is good for the suburbs. Someone who's not going to sort of come as an outsider and talk about tearing down the system. I think that's the recurring, and you talk about this a lot, Sagar, that's the recurring lesson from the past 4 years.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say it can both be true that everyone in the DNC and Obama and everybody else tried to throw the election behind Joe Biden, and that Joe Biden had some appeal to somebody somewhere. And you have to figure out how to disaggregate those parts and to make sure that you can win over the parts that you actually control. The people in power are never going to be, you know, on your side, but you have a chance in terms of appealing to somebody. So focus on that part and not really on the others. And I think that by being a product of a system, by being part of the system, you can actually also effect change in an even more radical fashion. So Chris wants to know, where can I get a Rising coffee mug? And does the realignment have a coffee mug? So Rising coffee mug, I believe, by the way, I have no affiliation or whatever with this, is available beneath the show from like Teespring or something like that. As far as the realignment coffee mug, you are the first person to ask. I'm pretty sure it would only be you who wants one and my mom. But hey, if a bunch of you do, write in, let us know. I guess we'll have to make some coffee mugs.
This is the perfect time to introduce the audience to producer Phil. Phil has been producing the show for the past year. Phil.
He's our Jamie, for the record.
How are we, Phil, going to monetize merch? What's the strategy that we've had you put together?
Well, first off, hi, everyone. I'm producer Phil. It's nice to be on the other side of the mic. You guys let me out of the cage. No, I'm not going to give away all our monetizing strategies. Otherwise, we would, our competition would have a chance here.
Well, that's a very good answer, Phil.
So I'm going to hold some of that tight. But no, I think this is a good question. If there's an appetite for it, I think we'd consider it, right? I mean,
yeah, absolutely. So like I said, write in if you want a mug. Let us know. I'll make some. I'll send you one.
Yeah, maybe the next review ask will be sent in your review with a mug design or a T-shirt design. We'll pick the best one.
I like that one.
And listen, if you guys want us to make a grifty Patreon where we charge you $100 a month to turn out the product we're already doing, we're also open to that. So definitely write in if you want us to become Patreon people. I think that could be a huge opportunity for the three of us.
Write in and plan our strategies.
That's right.
So yeah, on to the last question, and this is the actual most serious question. This is a little long, but I actually want to read the full question here because it's great to hear that a realignment listener is thinking this deeply about the show, what we've really been trying to do here. So this is from David. David says, the premise of the realignment is that we are witnessing a systemic change in American politics, and the right will be carried along with that change. But as you acknowledged in your first episode this season, those changes are across the political spectrum. They're not just confined to the right. So what fascinates me is the question of whether either party will emerge from the grip of neoliberalism fully. That is, whether economic populism will overcome the most entrenched interests of corporations and then allow one of the two major parties to co-opt the multiracial working class vote. Or if we're just doomed for a future of trench warfare where both political parties are simultaneously fighting against each other and then managing their own infighting. What do you think about that, Sagar?
Yeah, it's such an important question, David. And here's what I would say, which is that there is the greatest political opportunity of the century right now, which is neither party is working towards the wants and needs of, as you said, the multiracial working class. Now let's look at the political dynamics of both of those parties. One of those parties has Donald J. Trump at his helm. Donald J. Trump was elevated to office with a working class populist message, which, with a few tweaks, could absolutely have increased its voting share amongst Latino and African American populations. Okay, so that's one party. However, he's governed, while in office, very much more like a more traditional Republican, with all of the chaos that just comes along with the territory, not of populism, but really of Trump himself and how he manages his brand. But on the other side is Joe Biden. And Biden, with his pick with Kamala Harris, by so much of the actions of the Democratic Party, has given away the game, in my view. He has said, I want to be a bridge for the future of the Democratic Party to people like Pete Buttigieg. So what does that mean? That means that one of those parties has made the explicit choice with the top of the ticket, with the selection of Kamala Harris, by very likely a Pete Buttigieg at the very top of that administration. They are saying, we are going to realign this party around upper middle class, white, suburban people. The other party, let's say if Trump loses, could fight to become a party that tries to win back some of those upper middle class, white, suburbanites, ergo dooming us to the hellish, you know, trench warfare that you're talking about there. Or it could be a party which does try to appeal to that multiracial working class vote, which would dramatically change the political calculus. So that's kind of the battle lines that I lay out there. I think the Democrats in this election have kind of made that explicit choice to realign around richer suburban voters, but that the Republicans are in a civil war right now, and especially if Trump loses. If Trump loses, there's going to be two different camps, and I think you all know which side we're on here, which is one side says, hey, you could become the party of the working class, the party of your base, and you could win, you could actually win the popular vote in an election within our lifetimes. The other side is going to say, no, we want to actually steal back some of these affluent, you know, white liberals or people who vote on tax cuts back into our coalition and keep the party exactly where it is while also dithering around on social policy. So those are kind of the battle lines as I see them. There is absolutely no predestination here. Joe Biden could lose this election. Who knows, right? And then probably Bernie Sanders has, or AOC or whomever has an ever better shot of changing the Democratic Party. And Trump could lose, and then they could nominate somebody who is very much more like Mitt Romney, and then the parties could realign exactly the other way. So do not think that this goes one way or the other, but this is one way that I would like it to go. And those are kind of the dynamics that I see it.
This is the key thing that I want to build on from Sagar's conversation, which is that this is about politics when I interpret the question, because we can debate the policy implications of neoliberalism, but the thing that Republicans and Democrats both have to think about is, from a political perspective, how does a neoliberal agenda fit our actual ability to win? Now, neoliberalism, as we could see and are likely to see in November, is a great fit for the Democratic Party. It turns out that when you have a competent Biden campaign, which I think you've seen a very competent Biden campaign, that doesn't skip going to Wisconsin, focuses on Pennsylvania, and actually works on actually winning primaries in an effective way, you actually see that that party, a combination of college-educated, upper-income voters combined with racial minorities and a portion of the working class, that's an excellent political coalition. That is a political coalition that if you could turn that out every 4 years, you are going to win national elections. That is a story of the Obama presidency. That is the story of the popular vote in the 2016 election, because obviously Hillary lost, but she still won 3 million more popular votes than Donald Trump did. And Donald Trump is still in this situation where he really does have to go into the former blue wall and win in those states like Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. So separate from our actual political beliefs and our beliefs on policy, neoliberalism seems to be a good political bet for Democrats moving forward. Now, what doesn't seem to be a good political bet moving forward, and this actually is a good segue into Sagar's introduction of the David Brooks piece, is neoliberalism combined with the Republican Party. Because the issue here is that The story of American politics ever since the end of the Reagan policy has been the Democratic Party's increasing performance amongst these college-educated, mostly white, upper-income voters. They have taken those voters away from the Republican coalition. It's wild to imagine, given today's context, but Ronald Reagan actually won the college-educated vote during the 1984 campaign. That's entirely something that is unimaginable today on a couple of different levels. Those voters are gone. Those voters are not simply voting on these fiscal issues. They're actually voting on sociocultural issues. I think Sagar will agree for many people are much more important. So for example, I think if you're you're a voter in suburban Virginia, you make around $300,000, $400,000 a year as a combined household. You're above that $250,000 upper middle class limit. You're probably not voting on your tax rate in national elections. You're probably voting about LGBTQ issues. You're probably voting about abortion. You're probably voting about those cultural issues that are a bigger signifier of your class interests than just money. And I think Republicans that think we could just come back after 2020, if there's a Trump loss, and just say, but Joe Biden's spending so much money, everyone, it's crazy. The socialism, the taxes, that is a coalition that maybe can win midterms, as we saw during the Obama presidency, but that is not a coalition that can actually win presidential elections. So what you'll sort of see happen, and this is the way I think this will probably play out if the populist right can't get it together, is we will just see a situation where the Republican Party gradually becomes the party of the midterms, the party of Congress, the party of opposition, and the Democratic Party becomes the party of the executive branch, where gradually speaking through Supreme Court appointees and general attrition and executive orders, they're able to push American domestic and foreign policy to the left.
I think that's a really good answer, Marshall. It's a good, actually, segue to this David Brooks piece that we teased at the top. Now, the piece is titled, Where Do Republicans Go From Here? Subquote, the party looks brain dead at every spot Trump touches, but off in the corners, there's a lot of intellectual ferment. It was a really interesting piece. I mean, it kind of basically is the thesis of the realignment. And the premises that he lays out, I think, are actually really important. So, Marshall, what do you think that those premises are that the listeners need to take away?
And before we jump into that, what's important about that piece is not only does it mention you, Orrin Cass, who is Group American Compass, is thinking through this issue, but also it talks about a bunch of Republican members, such as Mike Gallagher of Wisconsin, Senator Josh Hawley, Senator Marco Rubio, Senator Tom Cotton, who we've actually spoken to on the show. So be sure to go back into the archives if you found this conversation interesting, or if you enjoyed that piece, to really get a longer discussion with them. But the basic summary of the piece is David Brooks unsurprisingly thinks that Donald Trump is doomed for a historic, catastrophic loss in November. That's something that I largely believe is true. However, where this gets interesting, though, is despite his sort of centristy brand, he argues that the basic Trumpian worldview on issues like immigration, trade, foreign policy, etc., will continue to shape the GOP for the following decades. And most importantly, whether or not he disagrees with those ideas, they are actually the ideas that are needed to help the party win. So Sagar, firstly, for everyone, can you just define what you think the basic Trump worldview on immigration, trade, and foreign policy is, divorced from the man himself?
Yeah, and that's the most important part, right? Which is that there's Trumpism, if there is such a thing, and then there's Trump himself. That's something I actually talked about earlier in the pod. There are a lot of things that are just unique to Trump the man. Trust me, I've met him a couple of times, spent a couple hours with him, actually. And, you know, if you believe in Trumpism, what do you believe? Or and maybe, Marshall, you can weigh on this after I'm done talking, which is maybe it's not even useful to call it Trumpism. I don't really know. But the way it would look is you are skeptical of the neoliberal claim, which is very much up in the air in terms of the economic data and more, that immigration overall is always good because it increases GDP. And that increased GDP is distributed widely across our society, and ergo, it's always good for America. On trade, it's the same thing. You are skeptical of the view that free trade between sovereign nations always leads to lower consumer prices for all, which is always better for the American consumer. And on foreign policy, you're skeptical of the view, which was pushed predominantly in the Bush administration, that the United States can enforce its values by force, and that all of its security decisions, national security decisions, should be made on the basis of the value of the country itself and not necessarily on the actual cost-benefit analysis of the relations between those two countries. I would say that kind of in an essence is what a Trumpist view of the world would look like. And I think coincidentally, it's also what, I don't know, maybe 75% of the American public probably agrees with.
Building on that, I'd like your point about debating what we even sort of call this, because I think the problem with Trumpism as a term is that it sort of over-personalizes it. So you've actually seen this on the, this isn't just an issue of sort of never Trumpers and the sort of left. It's actually an issue with Republicans. So you've seen a lot of failed populist candidates say they're Trumpist, and instead of actually developing a serious body of thought, actually advancing useful policy, they think Trumpism just means being sort of shouty and being very rude. There's this annoying Trump-era Republican politician aesthetic of being very sort of aggressive towards the press. Not that that's inherently the worst thing or inherently that's bad, but it's just sort of annoying because it's very vapid. It doesn't really mean anything. You just get the sense that people, that's this sort of, oh, you did it again, media. It's like, okay, cool. But like, what do you think about immigration or what are your thoughts on trade? And there's nothing there. So Trumpism leads, I think, vapid sort of thought. But to the broader point, this whole article and the broader debate we're having here, and this is the debate we need to have and what we're going to foster on this show, is very much this idea of, regardless of what you believe about policy, the notion that we can go back to the way the world looked in 2015 is just ridiculous. It's not possible. You're not able to sort of put the baby back together again after Trump won his election. Trump was not in our view, I don't want to speak for you too much, Sagar, but I think in our view, the reason why the Trump worldview matters in the long term is, look, Republican voters, the voters who actually show up in those midterms, in those presidential election years, in those places that are actually vulnerable to getting picked up, such as Michigan, they're immigration skeptics. They're not going to vote Republican because there was comprehensive immigration reform. They're not going to vote Republican because DACA happened. Now, I actually support DACA. I actually largely support comprehensive immigration reform, but I cannot go through the world believing that the way the Republican Party does better is by moving to the left on the immigration issue, because that clearly is something that's not true. I largely support the free trade order, but I also know that I can't just go about to Republican voters saying, hey guys, did you know in 1945, the whole set of the American people came in agreement that we're going to defend the liberal world order and prevent free trade? That didn't happen. That's undemocratic. That's not real. Same thing on foreign policy. Sagar, I think foreign policy is the area where you and I probably disagree the most. But the thing that I will always concede to your side is just this idea that yours is much more grounded in, I think, an actual reflection of people's views. I think it's something that more people have consented to. I just don't think there's any significant body of the American people, especially on the Republican side, who have come down in favor of preserving the liberal world order. Now, I support that preservation. I think it's worth doing. I think free trade is good. But Republican politicians and center-left politicians, when it comes to sort of the socialist left, have done a terrible job, and I think this is due to entitlement, of actually articulating these things in a way that reflects that they are not popular. And it's not a conspiracy that they're not popular. It's not this evil Trumpist aberration, but it's just a basic fact.
Yeah, I think that's the most important point, right? Which is that at least recognize it. At least, you know, if you want to make the argument, and there's an argument to be made, you know, I'll be the first one to let somebody say it. Just, you have to make it in good faith and not assume that people are stupid or they don't know anything about economics or, oh, you fool, you haven't read this one hand-picked study that I found that the Washington Post says has two thumbs up, or, you know, Pinocchio's or whatever that they're using these days. That is really what I think it's all about. And so the broader thing that I really love about the David Brooks piece is that, look, I mean, David Brooks is not, you know, really somebody you would think is on our side, or not necessarily somebody who has been sympathetic to Trump or even to necessarily the kind of politics that I push. But he actually concludes in his piece that the only way that the GOP can win, and remember, what do we care most about on this podcast? Power. So if you actually care about attaining power, having power and executing it, is that you have to do what we're talking about here. You have to be skeptical of free trade, or you very least have to enforce it in a way that benefits the majority of your populace. You have to be skeptical of foreign intervention. You have to justify that intervention to the American people. And same thing whenever it comes to immigration. So those are the things that I think are the most important. They're not reflected in the mainstream GOP kind of whatsoever. And by adopting these values, by adopting these worldviews, it's a way that the Republican Party could actually win a popular vote, an electoral vote victory, in American politics after the year 2020. So such an important story. I really recommend everybody go and check it out.
I just want to finish up with a quick takeaway of a quote from Senator Sasse that I actually really disagreed with, and it's very important to note. So Senator Sasse says, "I think politicians are arsonists. The main thing the GOP does is try to light the Democrats on fire. And the main thing Democrats do is light Republicans on fire. That's why there's so little trust in politics." I have to push back against that notion, because that's not why there's a lack of trust in our political system. There's a lack of trust in our political system because post-1970s, faith in every single institution in American life has gone down. It's the media, it's big business, it's our local elected officials. It's not just these contexts of politics. So I think just trying to overly individualize things, trying to over-personalize things, just misses the broad point. I think there's little trust because our institutions themselves don't actually work. That's what feeds the partisanship. It's not as if Democrats and Republicans woke up one day and just sort of said, "Hey, we don't trust each other, so let's start fighting." There actually was a real lack of consensus anymore. Something that happened post-1970s is the New Deal order broke down. And this is something that is talked about in the Robert Caro book we mentioned earlier. Rick Perelstein writes about this. This sort of formula for American success post-World War II really sort of lasted until the 70s, and then it stopped working. Once it stopped working, that's what caused, I think, the arson. That's what caused a lot of the fighting. And that's what caused the further distrust when combined with things like Watergate. So I think if there's something I want to do with this show, if there's something what I want to do with every single thing the realignment touches, it's how do we find this new order? How do we come up with a new consensus that can actually work for Americans so that the trust be rebuilt that way? Not by simply saying, let's just be nice to each other, as if you know, AOC and Matt Gaetz sitting down and having a civil conversation would lead to any sort of better outcome in our political system.
I love that. Okay, so with that, we are very much looking forward to bringing you guys a new episode next week with Zach Carter. Some of you may have seen him on Rising. He's the author of The Price of Peace. It's a new biography of John Maynard Keynes. It's absolutely fantastic. And Zach and I have talked a lot offline kind of about a lot of the things you guys will find interesting: the future of the left, the future of the right, the economic response to the coronavirus depression that we find ourselves in the middle of right now. And I think it will be a very, very useful episode for everybody involved.
And for a preview of what that conversation is going to look like, I just listened to an episode that Zach recorded with Joe Weisenthal of the Oddlots podcast. And he had this point where he said, the Democratic response to the 2008 financial crisis was the Occupy Wall Street movement in 2011, and the Republican response was Trump's presidency in 2016. So now that we're sitting during this COVID-19 era, the conversation I want to have, what all of us need to be thinking about, is what is the Democratic response to this coronavirus recession going to look like? What is the Republican response going to look like? Because with both those examples, we didn't really see the effect, whether it was the Trump campaign or the Bernie campaign, until almost 10 years after they happened. So when you're listening to this conversation next week, think about these themes and think about, what is this going to mean for 2032? What is this going to mean for my kid when they're 5 or 6 years from now? That's the thing that's so important about this conversation with Zach. With that, we'll see you next week. Don't forget to write us questions at realignmentpod@gmo.com and leave us a 5-star review. And as always, thank you, Lincoln Network, for sponsoring the show. It's a great time being here for all of you.